Hello, baby bats and scaredy cats. It is I, again, Isabella L. Price, host of the Nocturnal Emissions show, and I am back for another episode. In this episode, we'll be discussing some pop culture news, some things that have happened in the horror world, including the new Suspiria movie and also the new Child's Play movie. Also, some very salacious tweets from Guillermo del Toro. And we'll also be talking about one of California's most notoriously haunted and notorious murder homes. All right, stay tuned. All right, so I wanted to talk to you guys about a couple of things that are going on in the horror news world. I'm sure that you might have already heard about these things. I'm sure that you might. That's not proper English. Anyway, one of the things that has happened over the course of the last week is that there have been more pictures dropped of the new Child's Play movie. Now, I know that this is really kind of a hot button sort of a topic right now because not many people are responding very well to the new Child's Play movie. Now, I might be in the minority. Also, we all know that horror fans are notoriously hard to please. It's true. And also we know that that horror fans don't always have... Oh man, this is hot. This is a real hot thing to say. Horror fans don't really have great taste. Oh man. It's true. I know that we've been going through it a lot with the, what was it, Vanity Fair article that said that 2018 was a horrible year for horror, which was not true at all. But at the same time, I do think that horror fans can tolerate things of a lower quality more than anybody else. And part of that is because for a lot of fans, there is this metric of like, well, I wasn't scared, so it doesn't really qualify as being horror. And there was actually somebody who did research to show that the less money that a horror movie costs to make, the more people actually like it. So the worse it does, like critically, the more kind of crappy the special effects are, the more horror fans actually really love it. And the more money that was in the budget for the film, the less horror fans really love it, which is wild. There's no other genre out there where it's like that except for horror, and I'm fascinated by it, but also minutely repelled by it at the same time. And we're going through it with this new Child's Play movie. Now, Don Mancini, who was the, I hope I'm saying that right, he was the original writer for the first movie. I don't know if he's written for many other ones, but he wrote for the first one, and he was not a fan of the new Child's Play movie, of the reboot. There was this kind of shady, snarky tweet that he had, which was so wild. Like, to see Don Mancini tweet, "I don't know her," with a Mariah Carey meme was just like, all right, just can we put the button on this wild year? 2018 has been a wild year, and it's been so long. The Olympics happened in 2018. That's how long this year has been. It's just been a very long year. I'm ready for it to come to a close. I want to speed right through to 2019. I'm hoping to achieve new things and have new projects and actually get things finished in 2019. That's my goal. Well, so he didn't really like the news that was coming out about the new Child's Play. He's not involved at all in it. And it's getting a new writer and a new director. The writer and the director are not really known for much. The writer, I think, has Kung Fury 2 on his credits, and I think that's the biggest thing. And the director, is a director of short horror films, of which I haven't seen either. The producers are the producers behind It, which was a really good movie, and it made a ton of money. So, yeah, there's that. The thing that's really selling it for me, though, is the two leads. The two leads are Aubrey Plaza from Parks and Rec and Brian Tyree Henry from Atlanta. He plays Paperboy in Atlanta, and he is such a good actor. I just saw him in Widows, and he is so good. He is so capable of playing so many different kinds of roles. Like, he can go from warm and cuddly and funny to being melancholy and sad and introverted to being like terrifying in the blink of an eye. He's so talented, and I love Aubrey Plaza. I love her dry sense of humor. So I was all in. Like, I thought that, okay, yeah, I mean, I don't know these directors. The producers are great. But I have full faith in these actors. Brian Tyree Henry has never picked a project that I didn't like, and so I have full faith in that. Also, if I could be very honest with you, the Child's Play, the Chucky movies are not the best. The sequels are not the best, okay? Like, Bride of Chucky was a great movie. Tiffany is a horror diva icon for the ages, but all the other Chucky movies are bad. I didn't see Cult of Chucky. I think that's the last one that came out. But the reviews from that also said that it was disappointing. So I'm not really that like hardcore about this. I know that lots of people feel like, oh man, I don't know, the reboot. It's like, yeah, but some things need to be rebooted. I mean, really nothing in the world needs to be rebooted, but at the same time, like, you can have a new, fresh look at the Chucky mythos. I mean, do I have to remind people that the whole thing about Chucky is that he is a doll that a white man put through a voodoo ritual, put his soul inside of this doll? Like, come on, that doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anymore. And I don't even think people think about that anymore. They just think that Chucky is Chucky and that's it. But it's not a really great premise. And the idea that they're going for with the new one is that there is this doll called Buddy, and Buddy can do anything. It's kind of like a Teddy Ruxpin sort of a doll, but he's like, you know, he's got Wi-Fi and stuff like that. And he malfunctions and he turns into a murderer. And I think that that's a really interesting idea. The pictures that are coming out show this doll that is kind of like anime-ish, you know, he's got big eyes and a big round face and he's super cute. And that to me is more terrifying than seeing a doll that's like super scarred up and stuff like that. So I am actually looking forward to this a lot. I know what people are saying. I know. But I'm actually looking forward to this a lot. So another thing that actually happened this week, it happened today, was that Guillermo del Toro went to Twitter and talked about the unproduced, unmade works that he has, the scripts that he has. And this caused a huge, well, I don't want to say a huge kerfluffle, but it got people all on Twitter, basically because what he was saying was that he has all these ideas, he has completed scripts in hand, ready to go, ready to be produced, and nobody is producing these things, which sounds crazy, right? Because it's Guillermo del Toro, he has had a significant number of critical success and also financial success with his films, and he has the scripts that are ready to go, and even someone as talented, who has such a long career, has had such a proven track record, has a hard time getting his work made, which is just wild, and what hope does that give the rest of us? I mean, good God, none of us are working on the level that he's working on. So it's just, it was kind of disheartening to hear that. But so he lists, these are the lists of the films which he has fully written or co-written that are unproduced so far. One is The Witches, which I am assuming is the Roald Dahl book. Justice League Dark, which is a very interesting idea because the Universal Dark franchise did not go over well. Beauty and the Beast, which I'm also going to assume is taking place from not the Disney version, but from the original fairy tale version. At the Mountains of Madness, Fantastic Voyage, or Voyage, as I like to say. The Count of Monte Cristo, which would be incredible, oh my goodness. Mephisto's Bridge, Pacific Rim 2, parentheses, very different, is what this man says. I can't imagine that he was satisfied with the with Pacific Rim 2. I can't imagine that he was satisfied with the direction that that movie went in. It was not at all a good sequel. The movie really felt like it was pandering to some sort of commercial enterprise that was trying to sell more tickets to China. It felt like someone had gone to China and had made a really bad deal, and they had to put a whole bunch of Chinese celebrities, and it felt really bad and soulless. And that's a real shame because I love a giant kaiju, I love a giant robo, and this movie was supposed to be kind of kicking off the giant kaiju, giant robo franchise, and it really didn't. So, okay, moving on. He also lists Secret Project, parentheses, Untitled, close parentheses, which tells us nothing. But I like that he included that. A movie called Superstitious, Nightmare Alley, The Haunted Mansion, which I'm also going to assume is from, based off of the Disney park ride, which I think he's talked about before. The Hulk pilot, which is very interesting. The Buried Giant, The Coffin, Drood, A List of Seven, parentheses, Mark Frost. So I'm not too sure about List of Seven or The Buried Giant or Coffin, but the idea of him doing The Count of Monte Cristo, absolutely, please do that. Please do, please. I would, oh my God, how much money would I pay to watch Guillermo del Toro make Beauty and the Beast? Like, the original fantasy. See, this is a problem that I have with Guillermo del Toro. This man makes so much stuff that reaches directly into my heart. It's, and I don't want to be vain. Like, I don't want to make it seem like, you know, like this, like del Toro got my live journals and he's been copying me. Like, it's just that he makes works that speak so directly to me, and it's hard sometimes. People all the time talk to me about it, and they think, like, they say to me, oh, you really must like his work because it's so you. But how can I explain this? It feels like I'm being exposed sometimes. Like, sometimes I watch his work and I feel raw when I watch it. Like, I did not like The Shape of Water at all because of the fact that it made me feel vulnerable. It made me feel very raw. It made me feel like this is a man, how old is he? Like 40, 50 years old? A Spanish man, a father of two, I think. How does he know me? How does he know my love of fairy tales, my love of folklore, my love of monsters, my disdain for authority figures? How does this man know these things? And it's just so remarkable how much his work is very personal to me. And it's so personal that I can't really even watch it sometimes because it just feels too, I feel too naked, I feel too exposed. But regardless, I would pay so much money to watch Beauty and the Beast. Expose me, Del Toro. Strip me raw, make me naked. Like, it's just, And it's wild that he has all of these projects that are just sitting on a shelf. That is wild, because we all know that terrible movies get made all the time. And yet, Del Toro is having a hard time getting his films made. And that is crazy to me. I don't understand it. So, Del Toro, hopefully now that he's published this, hopefully some people are going to get in contact with him, and probably some of these projects, I hope some of these projects are going to be picked up. I would love to see The Count of Monte Cristo, and I would love to see Beauty and the Beast. Those would be really exciting. And also The Witches, too. I thought actually The Witches was already being put into production, but maybe that's by somebody else. But yeah, I just can't believe that it just sounds so strange to me. So I wanted to talk a little bit about my thoughts of the new Suspiria movie. I had seen this movie, it was kind of a whirlwind week of, what did I see? I saw Overlord, I saw Halloween, and I saw Suspiria all in the same week. And so it was a whole bunch of horror stuff. Then I was also finishing up Sabrina, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. I was starting Daredevil. It was a lot. It was a lot of stuff. But one of the things that I really wanted to go into was my thoughts on the new movie. Now, I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of the original movie. The original Giallo film, the Argento version, is a really visually interesting film to me. Now, it's visually iconic for me. The color palette, the soundtrack, the shots, everything is just so amazing. And I was one of the early people who was just like, I don't want this film to be remade, because you can't. You can't remake this film. You can't, because all of these different elements that made the film as great as it is, you can't put those together again. And if you try, it's going to be some sort of false imitation of that. And so I wasn't really that looking forward to it. I heard when it came out, it was getting great reviews, but I was still really skeptical of the whole thing. Now, I saw it with a friend. The movie is nothing like the original. The movie is nothing like the original, not in looks, color palette, sound, acting, the plot of, I mean, the plot very loosely. I mean, if you've seen the first one, you know there are witches. The remake also, there are witches. The first one takes place in a dance studio or dance house. The second one also, there is dance. There's a lot of dance in the second one, actually. Now, personal note, I used to work for a avant-garde contemporary performance dance venue. And for several years, I was around performance arts dancers. And let me tell you that they are some of the craziest people I have ever met in my entire life. And modern dance is insane. It pushes your body to limits that your body should not go. It's very dangerous. And it's very hard to watch sometimes. There are some times where you watch it and there were plenty of performances where people just sort of left because they just couldn't watch it anymore. There's a lot going on with performance. So that rang really true to me. The sort of madness of that field rang really honest. And I really liked that. I could obviously tell that Tilda Swinton's performance was based on a bunch of different kinds of, she reminded me a lot of Martha Graham. She reminded me a lot of Pina Bausch. She had this just sort of madness, floppy madness to her that a lot of those choreographers do. So that really, I loved her performance. I love her in most things, though. She's remarkable. I'm not the biggest fan of Dakota Johnson. Now, the way that I've described it is that Dakota Johnson is like sour cream. No. She's like cream cheese. So when you put cream cheese on top of something that's more flavorful or more interesting, say a bagel or something like that, the cream cheese adds to the bagel, right? It enhances the flavor of the bagel, but cream cheese alone is flavorless. So you may have something and you think, well, I could really use something to kind of kick this up, kind of punch this up a little bit. And you add a little bit of cream cheese and you go, ooh, that, yes, actually, no. Cream cheese doesn't really punch anything up. It really mellows things out, actually. You're like, how can I make this flavor just a little bit calmer? How can I make this flavor just slightly blander, which would actually make me enjoy it more if it was slightly more bland? Cream cheese is like the food equivalent of watering something down, and that's how I feel about Dakota Johnson. Now, that's no shade. No, that's all tea. It's no shade. I'm not trying to like dismiss her or anything like that, but her performances and everything that I've ever seen, largely forgettable. Largely, she could be replaced by anybody else, and it's never really her. You know, it's never really like you're going to see this movie in order to see her. I don't really know of anybody who has that feeling. It's just like cream cheese. I mean, when was the last time you were just like, my God, I could go for a spoonful of cream cheese? When was the last time you ever just saw someone just chowing down on a bowl full of cream cheese? You would think that person was insane. You would think this person is out of their mind. That's how I feel about her. She's just very boring. You know, this is, I think Zoe Kravitz also has a cream cheese personality, and that's sad, but it's true. Okay, so moving on. Her performance was adequate. She showed up, she said her lines, she had all of her marks. She didn't look at the camera once. I thought she did great. She did a great job. Mia Goth was incredible. She's such a strange duck, that Mia Goth. I really am not sure about her. I was looking at her in the movie and I was like, what's so different about her? And then I realized that she had eyebrows and I was like, oh, yes, way to step it up. She's very interesting to me, very strange. But she's also another one that, when she first started acting, I was just sort of like, okay, you're very pretty. You're a very pretty, strange looking girl. She has this sort of long, far away stare to her, this sort of childlike face. And I'm like, okay, but what are you doing here? Like, what are you adding to this? And she was really stellar in this movie, and really enjoyed her performance. It was really heartbreaking. Chloe Grace Moretz? Anyway, the girl from Kick-Ass was here, and she was also really good. There was Tilda Swinton in a role that, where she was playing a person of the opposite gender, and it was incredible, and I fully endorse her getting a Oscar or nominated for something for that role, because it was crazy how good she was in that, how much she blended into the role. Although when she started speaking, I was like, oh, that's Tilda. But until then, I really couldn't tell. So the film is a huge departure, both stylistically and also really about the story details and the plots. It deals a lot with the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it not the fall of the Berlin Wall, but the Berlin Wall, that time period in German history, and post-World War II, pre-80, it deals a lot with that time period, and German survival guilt. Which is a really interesting backdrop to put onto this movie. There are parts where I felt like that was too much of the focus, and the focus away from these witches was not placed. I kept feeling the entire time like, I wish this movie had been made by a female director. I caught myself giving the director, the male director, credit for not using the male gaze throughout this film, even though he really could have, because there's a lot of nudity, there's a lot of dancing where these girls are kind of in skin-tight leotards, and there wasn't a lot of those lingering, creepy shots of nipples and butt cheeks and stuff like that, even though these girls didn't really have much. Anyway, there was not a lot of that, which I thought was really incredible, but like, that's the bar. Like, not being a creep does not deserve praise, and yet I was giving this person all the praise in the world for just not being a weirdo, and that's how far down that bar is. And I really just wish that it had been made with a woman's perspective. There were a lot of really incredible visual elements to this that made it very creepy and very unnerving, and when I left the theater I was kind of shaken afterwards. It was nighttime, it was rainy, it was cold, and I thought like, oh man, I feel like I'm gonna see an old woman at the corner of my eye, you know. So yeah, it had a lot to do with the themes of competition between women, sort of ageism being replaced, that sort of feeling, but it nothing really rang very true. And I wonder if I would have felt more sincerity had there been a feminine voice in this story about women. So there's that. I actually did not hate it. I mean, despite myself, I really thought I was gonna hate this movie, and I didn't. I actually find it to be really remarkable, but at the same time, it could have been better. It really could have been. There are parts of it that I just am very disappointed that they couldn't have employed just more. Also, there's a part at the end of the movie where it goes into this stilted camera effect that I absolutely hate, where like the shutter speed is sped up or something like that. I think it's the shutter speed is sped up, or maybe it's slowed down, something like that. And it is the worst camera effect, and I hate it so much, and it's employed all throughout the last act, and it's my least favorite thing in the whole world. So there's that. But it is worth going to see. It's definitely not a movie that you should go see with maybe like a loved one. Maybe not like a boyfriend or anything like that, but if you wanted to go see it, or maybe like not your mom or your grandma. But it's a great girls' night out movie. It really is. So those are my feelings about the new Suspiria movie. And have you seen it? I'm really curious to hear what other people have to say about this movie. I haven't really heard a lot of people talk about it. I mean, I've read think pieces, of course, but I'd like to hear what other people think about this movie. Did you enjoy it? If you did, or if you didn't, please tell me. I have a Facebook page, Nocturnal Emissions Show, where you just look that up. Nobody else was ridiculous enough to make Nocturnal Emissions the name of their page, and also Facebook hasn't taken it down yet. You can also find me on Twitter at NOCEMISS, knock in this. And you can also email me, nocturnalemissionsshow@gmail.com. And yeah, let me know what you think about Suspiria and how it measures up to the original. So this next story is a true story of a house that recently just sold after 50 years on the market. This house has inspired numerous shows about murders and hauntings and was part of the inspiration for the American Horror Story show. This is one of California's most notorious and bloody and gruesome homes, sites to a terrible crime that happened around Christmas time. And so I picked this one because of the fact that it's around the time in which this murder had happened. And also it's a fascinating story about if this house is really truly haunted or if there's just something else that's going on, but it stood empty for 50 years. The house that I'm talking about is most commonly known as the Los Feliz murder home. Now, the house, it stands upright on a hilltop. It sort of stares down at everyone who dares to even approach it. There's large balcony windows, and you almost expect a light to appear sometimes. Maybe sometimes you expect a figure to move in between the curtains. For over 50 years, the house stood empty, but not entirely alone. See, on the night of December 6, 1959, a terrible crime happened, and ever since then, this house has been frozen. Frozen on that very night. There's rumors, people who sort of break into the home and take a look around, that there is still a Christmas tree erected in part of the house, that there's still magazines and newspapers, there's still food dated from that time period, that nothing has really changed. It's a time capsule. The house stopped being looked after. Now, the story, according to LA Weekly writer Brian Clune, is about Dr. Harold Pearson, was a prominent surgeon specializing in allergies and, bear with me while I try to pronounce this, cardiothoracics. That was hard. He gained a successful and profitable patent for a new type of syringe, had written one of the most respected clinical reports of the time, the Electrocardiogram in Familial Periodic Paralysis, which was featured in the magazine American Heart Journal in June of 1949, and was a well-respected keynote speaker in medical conferences all around the country. Pearson was an assistant head of cardiology for the School of Medicine at USC and was on the surgical team of cardiology at the Los Angeles County General, Cedars of Lebanon Hospital, and the Santa Fe Hospital of Los Angeles. Dr. Pearson's life, by all accounts, was a storybook life of wealth, fame, and unmitigated success. So what I'm about to tell you then won't really make a lot of sense. You see, that night of December 6, Harold returned from work. He said hello to his wife Lillian, who was fixing dinner, and his children, 18-year-old Judy, 13-year-old Joseph, and 11-year-old Debbie, who all ate dinner together around the dining room table before watching some TV and heading off to sleep. Sometime around 4 a.m., Harold woke up. He gathered himself out of bed, headed downstairs to a toolbox, and took out a ball peen hammer. He then climbed the stairs again and entered his bedroom, where he struck his wife in the head over and over and over until her head was an unrecognizable mess. In the night, Judy heard her mother's cries, the sound of her head being struck, the grunt of her father's blows, and got up. When Harold moved, covered in gore and viscera of his wife, to her room, raised the hammer again, and came down onto Judy. Judy raised her arm. She was already awake at this time. This broke the blow, but the hammer still made contact with her head, and Judy, stunned and shocked, stumbled and screamed at her father. It was then that Debbie walked into the room. She must have scared her father. He hadn't anticipated that Debbie would be really so eager. He must have thought that she would wait her turn to meet her end. He came to her, kneeling down so that his bloodied face and hers were level, and told her, in the calm, reassuring way that only a father can talk to his child, that it was all a dream, and she should go back to sleep. What Harold didn't know was that Judy's screams had woken the neighbors, who had already called the police. While Harold talked to Debbie, Judy ran out of the home to meet the neighbors in the yard, her face streaked with blood and panic. Harold then returned to her room, but she had already slipped out. He searched for Judy under her bed, in the closet. She must be hiding from him, but he was on a mission. Someone else had to die that night. While he searched, Debbie, unquieted by the most bizarre dream that she had ever really had, got her little brother up, Joseph, and quietly as they could, slipped past their father and out of the house. It was then that Harold noticed it. The quiet. The house was empty. And I think it's around this time that he realized that he had failed. He had a mission, he had an objective, and I think it was now that he'd start to let that realization sink into him that he had failed. But to Harold, one more person needed to die that night. So he moved to a bathroom where he grabbed a bottle of tranquilizers and painkillers. Remember, he is a doctor, so he probably had access to all these things, and took the remainder of the bottle, and that put an end to Harold. See, no one knows why he did it. There was no note, nothing leading up to it, just rumors. The Pearsons were facing money problems, some said. Others said that Harold had been seeking treatment for a mental illness and spent time in a mental ward for suicide attempts. When the police arrived, they checked in on the children to make sure that they were safe, sent Judy in an ambulance for her injuries. When they knocked on the door, no one answered. The house was again silent. When they climbed the stairs, they found two bodies. One was the brutalized body of Lillian Pearson. Where her head should be was nothing but bloody carnage. And the other was the crumbled, poisoned body of Harold Pearson. On the floor beside the bed lay a bottle of pills in one hand and a bloody hammer in the other. There in the nightstand was the book that Harold had been reading before bed. Dante's Divine Comedy, where a man descends down into hell. It was opened to canto number 1. Midway upon the journey of life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. The children were taken away to live with a family member to recover from their injuries, both physical and also psychological. A year later, the house was sold, but the ones who bought it never moved in. They left the house in the same condition that it was on that night. Why? Why buy a house that had so much tragedy and horror almost immediately and use it as a storage space? Yes, a storage space. For decades, the owners of the house let it rot and decay and crumble, not touching the belongings of the family who experienced the worst nights that anybody could ever possibly imagine. If you believe the former owners, there was really no reason. They just wanted a storage space in a 12-room mansion where a murder-suicide happened. But if you believe the neighbors, also the squatters and trespassers, it might be something else. The homeless would leave, citing cold spots, mysterious footsteps, and cries and moans throughout the house. The neighbors would see a woman standing in the upstairs window whose face would just disappear as she looked down from above. And the ghost hunters who came looking for evidence of the paranormal would see shapes, shadows, and lights. But once they would look through the evidence of their cameras, would find nothing. No trace of the ghost that they had thought that they had captured. The neighbors complained that occasionally the security alarm put on by the owners of the house to ward off trespassers would sometimes just go off without anybody nearby. It just triggered. There are other rumors. Rumors that if you peer in the windows, you can see things like trees, old can of SpaghettiOs, a Life magazine on the table. But the Pearsons were Jewish, so why the tree? And the magazine and SpaghettiOs came out after the murders, so who put them there? Well, the rumor is that another family did move in before it was sold as storage. And on the anniversary of the deaths, something happened. Something so terrifying and strange that the family just left, just got in their car, just drove away, not taking any of their belongings with them. And after that, the owners of the house stopped renting to anybody and just used the house as storage. Well, in 2016, the house went up for sale. It was described as a 1925 house featuring four bedrooms and a grand entrance with a step-down living room with serene views, formal dining room, a library slash study, a large kitchen, and a ballroom with a bar on the third floor. Wow. I mean, that sounds perfect. I mean, who wouldn't want to live there? It sold for $2.29 million to a couple who view it as the perfect, quote, fixer-upper. Well, I hope that they're all right. And I hope, come Christmas time, that the ghosts that live inside of the Los Feliz murder home find it within their souls to finally rest. All right, so that was tonight's episode. Thank you so much for listening. And if you like this show, please follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can also find us on iTunes. Please give it good ratings. Please share with your friends. I would love to have this podcast be listened to by more people. I also would love to hear from you. And if you have any true tales of terror, any UFO sightings, did you run into a Bigfoot? Did you see a ghost at Thanksgiving? Did the turkey come alive and did it try to eat you? I want to know everything. I also really want to know about the horror movies that are coming up in 2019 that you are really excited for. And I hope to see you again at the next episode, which is going to be in 2 weeks. So take care. Stay hydrated. Don't watch the news. Actually, you know what? Do watch the news. Stay informed. And remember, stay weird. Okay? Bye!